Welcome to Sports Business Secrets. I'm your host, Kevin Tarka. This podcast is specifically designed to share secrets from experts in the sports business world to help you along your own path to success in this industry. Each episode is packed with lessons and insights that never expire. You'll hear from general managers of professional teams to CEOs of sports tech companies to agents, coaches, players, and everything in between. I invite you to join me in real time on my personal journey of representing players and coaches, traveling the world, and always finding a way to battle through obstacles in this competitive industry. Nick, welcome to Sports Business Secrets.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So we've talked about doing this for a few years now, it seems, but as they say, better late than never. I'm definitely happy to have you on board here.
Absolutely. I've been looking forward to it.
So we have a long agenda of topics I'd love to cover here. So let me get right into a quick intro for those who might not be familiar. So Nick is a recently retired professional basketball player, originally from the state of Maine, arguably one of the best prospects to ever come from Maine. He took home the Gatorade Player of the Year award his senior year, averaging 36.5 points during that season, just a couple of buckets here and there. He went on to play 4 years at Maryland, again, putting up just a few stats. I believe this stat is still correct, but he's one of only five players in Maryland history to end with over 1,500 points, 500 rebounds, 200 assists, 100 steals, 100 threes, and 50 block shots. He then went undrafted in 2006 NBA draft and eventually signed with the Pistons as a free agent. And then jumped over to Europe to start his historically successful career from Germany to Spain to Israel to Japan to France and a few others in between. And that's just a small piece of the basketball background. But what I'm just as excited about talking about today is to dive into who Nick is as a player off the court. And I know the audience is going to learn a ton from that as well. So that was just a short, brief little intro here. And on this podcast, we'd like to dive into behind the scenes and share sports business and life secrets with the audience that they cannot find online. Before we dive into all the topics, I'll give you a minute or two just to share with the audience who you are, where you're from, where you grew up, and then we'll get into the rest of it.
Yeah, I appreciate the intro. I mean, you covered some of the stuff that I like to hear about, some of the accolades. I grew up in Maine. Traveled for 16 years as a pro, been really active as an entrepreneur for the last 10 plus years off the court, recently retired, turned 40 in a couple of days, and living dad life. I have about to be 4-year-old daughter. So that's a huge highlight of my life at this point. But other than that, you covered it. I mean, being from Maine has always been a big part of who I am, and very prideful to be from a place like Maine, and to your point, kind of not necessarily rich in basketball history, but there's been a lot of strides over the years and I'm really proud of it. And, you know, there's some proof in the pudding with Cooper Flagg. If anybody's familiar with him, he's probably the best player in the world under 18, and he's a Maine kid I know really well and have a great relationship with. So excited to be on with you and really interested to talk about, you know, like you said, things on and off the court that, you know, I'd love to share some of my experience with players or whomever is interested.
I love it. So we'll try and start in like the early timeline and then fast forward through, you know, through college and then through your pro years. So let's begin with your youth basketball experience. Because obviously everyone sees the highlights and the pro stuff, but what a lot of people don't talk about is how people get there. So can you talk about your experience a little bit? Let's start maybe from middle school until high school, just in regards to like, how much did you practice? You know, how, in other words, how badly did you want it, right? So what was your schedule like? What was the AAU lifestyle like? Although I know it's changed dramatically over the years. Talk a little bit about just like the early days of really being, you know, doing what you have to do to become the best basketball player.
Yeah, I mean, that part of it to me is one of the most special parts of kind of my story as a player, because some of my fondest memories are as a kid. You know, I came up in a place where basketball wasn't necessarily all that popular, although there's a huge culture of people that are passionate about it. My dad was a huge and still is a huge basketball fan. So from a young age, you know, whatever made the stars align, you know, I fell in love with the game of basketball. And one of the things that I tell young players is that, you know, it's hard to kind of explain that level of passion, because in some regards, I feel like you either love the game or you don't. And I think loving the game and really enjoying it is a really key foundation in the ability to have success. There are players, obviously, who talent leads the way, and maybe they don't even love the game that much, but they certainly have the ability to see their career through. For me, at a young age, the biggest memory that I have and the fondest memory is just how much I played. You know, I try to explain it to kids. I would play all day in the summer, literally from when I woke up until, you know, I had to go to sleep. You know, in a place like Maine, I would play with goalie gloves on in the winter. I would use my mom's car headlights, you know, when it was dark. I mean, I just love the game. I was obsessed with the game. And so it's a pretty easy explanation for me is how it started. And it was just that I love the game so much that all I wanted to do was play. So to me, it was more like playing than practicing. It's interesting now when kids play, it's like practice, it's more scheduled. I was just going outside and playing nonstop as a kid. And, you know, obviously AAU was there. But from age probably 8 until 13, it was just play all day with my friends, inside, outside, open gyms, wherever I could find a place to play, lower the hoop so I could dunk. And then as I, you know, kind of, I think that helped with my athleticism, raising the hoop and kind of, you know, going, you know, if I could dunk it, then I'd raise it a little more, dunk it, raise it a little more. But yeah, that was the start for me. And I just have, when I think back, even when I go back to Maine, I go and I'll drive around sometimes, especially now that I'm done playing, to reminisce of like, I'll drive to all the places that I played because it's just such great memories of how much time I would spend there and how much excitement I would have just to go play. You know, so even now when I go up to Maine, I'll take time and drive around to different places I would play and kind of just park there and reminisce a little bit, because it was, you know, one of my favorite things to do as a kid, and you know, I was really passionate about it.
Now, was basketball your only sport?
I played a lot of sports when I was young. I mean, I played baseball through middle school. I played football as a freshman. Like, I would play outside, home run derby and stuff, but as far as you know, real commitment, I'd say I was kind of all in on basketball from like fifth grade on. You know, and so I would dedicate pretty much the entire season to basketball, which I think was definitely beneficial for me.
Yeah, that's interesting. So what's your take? Because now I think, you know, and it can go both ways. I think it's case by case, depending on the player and really how much they love the game. But now you see, you know, a lot of multi-sport athletes, that some of which maybe if they focus on one sport, they would be better. But some of which you're just like, look, this kid is tremendous at all these sports and he can do that. And maybe some sports help, you know, for example, for basketball, if somebody plays baseball, like maybe certain things help their basketball game, learning it in the game of baseball. You know what I mean? So what's your take on like the multi-sport athlete versus committing all your time year round to being a basketball player?
Yeah. I mean, I think to your point, it's probably circumstantial, and, you know, I think it speaks to the value of having good counsel, whether it be parents or whether it be advisors, you know, helping, you know, with that decision-making process. My parents were really vocal, specifically my dad, about the risk of injury in football. And that's one of the reasons why I was steered away from football. And, you know, baseball for me was more of a personal preference. But I think that at least from like the young age, I think it's fair to give a kid the ability to develop and, you know, see, you know, hey, where is my best bet? You know, what do I love the most? And giving them all a shot. My personal opinion is that, you know, once you have the ability to identify which one either you're most passionate about or which one you have the best chance to be successful, which again, I think sometimes that comes to, you know, not everybody has that voice. And I'm very grateful that I did have that sort of guidance and leadership in my life, but you know, I think there's something to be said for commitment and time and working on your craft and really focusing on being great at one thing as opposed to being good at a bunch of things. I think that kind of translates to life off the court as well in some ways. But, you know, for me, it was like, I love basketball. This is what I want to do. Let me just go all in. So I think that, you know, it can go both ways. I personally would, with my daughter, you know, I would try to, you know, first kind of, here's all the great things that life has to offer and, you know, see where her passion is and follow that passion and then try to just use my experience to guide it in a direction of, you know, most chance to be successful, best, you know, opportunities, et cetera.
For sure. And then you get to a point where you either realize this is what you want to do or, you know, you get to a point where it's like people are noticing you and you're that good, whether it's, you know, by scouts calling you or by rankings, which is something I want to talk about too. So at what point did you realize that you were really that good and that you might be able to A, play at the next level, but B, play after that level and play after college as a pro? Like when was that for you? Like, were you getting calls early on? Were you getting calls by prep schools? Were you on certain rankings or were you not? And how did that affect your trajectory?
Yeah. I mean, you know, my first knee jerk on that is one of the things that I'm grateful from being from Maine is that I think because a lot of the things I did were relatively uncharted waters for a Maine basketball player, my level of appreciation and gratitude for every opportunity that I got was heightened. Like for me, playing on my varsity team was a huge deal. You know, like I looked up to the high school players when I was in middle school. I looked up to the high school players at Deering High School. And what was in front of me was where my sort of, you know, the people I idolized were. So when I had the opportunity, my dad's from Los Angeles. I grew up in Maine, obviously. He wanted me to go to the pump and run camp out in California. And so I went out there with no expectations. And immediately the Pump brothers, who were really, you know, energetic characters and, you know, had a really successful AAU program. They immediately asked me to go to Vegas big time with them. And at that point, it was all like happened really fast. I wasn't really recruited. I was going into my, I believe, sophomore year. And so again, the ability to go to this Vegas, I mean, they gave me a bag of gear and I thought that bag of gear was the most unbelievable thing, you know, and I was so appreciative and it was like the biggest deal to me. And I think every little micro step of the way was that way. And that's one of the reasons why I say I was so grateful for where I'm from, because I had this heightened level of appreciation where juxtaposed to that, I think there's a lot of players that don't realize how fortunate they are that have talent, you know, and, sure, they're sort of feel entitled and things happen for them right away. And like, they're that guy. And so it's just like, oh, this is the way it's supposed to be. I'm supposed to, you know, have everybody doing everything for me. And I'm supposed to have all this nice gear and, you know, everything's just going to happen for me. For me, it was like, everything came from the work. I was always underranked, undervalued, underappreciated. And so I always felt like I had that chip on my shoulder and I always was very humble and I always was very, you know, appreciative, like I said. So I think that was a huge part of me not necessarily even really realizing how good I was at any point. You know, I had that chip on my shoulder all the way through my career, even at Maryland, because I always kind of had to prove that I was either good enough to play, you know, D1. Then it was I good enough to play at Maryland? Then was I good enough to be a pro? And every step of the way, I felt like I had to prove myself. So I wouldn't change a thing. And that to me was a major reason that I was able to find success at, you know, whatever lane I was in.
Yeah, I think that there's something to be said about having a chip on your shoulder in any type of fashion, and rankings definitely go into that. I just think, you know, the guys or girls that are ranked up high are always looking behind them. And, you know, it could be very easy to get complacent and say, yeah, you know, you went viral on this clip, or you got an offer from this school, or you're ranked top 10 in ESPN's, whatever. Whereas the unranked, the ones that are continuously working to prove themselves, you know, it ends up, if you it takes time to see, but if you look back over history, those are the ones that, you know, most of them have a longer career. Now, obviously there's going to be a top, you know, I think that class, I went back to refresh, that was 2002, right? So that was Carmelo, Amare, Stoudemire. Yeah. You have JJ Redick, you have Chris Bosh, you know, like those are some of the names that you were competing against. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think rankings, I know we talk about it a lot. It's a blessing and a curse. And, you know, obviously media has changed things tremendously, but
yeah,
you know, I just think it's important for players to hear your point of view. Like, look, you know, if you're ranked, great, congrats. If you're not, look what type of career you can have if you continue to work. Whether you get ranked in middle school, in high school, in college, or never, you can have a successful career.
Yeah, I mean, I would piggyback that and say rankings are good for affirmation. Like, if you're ranked high, it means you're doing something right, you know?
Yep.
So use it as a tailwind. If you're not ranked, you know, I would, to your point, draw from hundreds of examples of players that weren't ranked. And I would say that things are different now. The accessibility to players from Maine, like, you know, I think there's a lot, like, you can be from anywhere now and have a ton of exposure. But the minute that you step foot on whatever campus you go, it doesn't matter what you were ranked. The minute you leave college, it doesn't matter where you went to college. You know, the minute you play in this league, it doesn't matter where you played the year before. So it's like, it's a really good preparation for young players to be able to manage, whether it's expectations or whether it's, you know, doubt, and how do we use whatever situation we're in as a motivator to just work. Like, if you're the number one ranked player, and I tell this to Cooper, is, well, that's just an opportunity for you to take advantage of it. And it's an affirmation that you're doing the right things. And it's an opportunity, but other than that, it doesn't mean a damn thing, you know? And so, but on, you know, again, if you're not ranked, then what better motivation? If you're ranked number one, you want to prove that you're number one, you should be number one. Great motivation. If you're not ranked, you want to prove that you can hang with the guys that are. So it's like, whatever the case may be, to me, the value is in how do you use that as an opportunity to motivate yourself to do what everybody has to do, no matter what position you're in, no matter what situation you're in. It's the attention to detail, it's the work, it's the consistency, you know. And the greats are the ones that are high ranked and do that stuff, and the ones that find their way are the ones that aren't ranked and do that stuff. Either way, you got to do that stuff. So no it's doubt. Just kind of how you manage the opportunity.
And for a guy like Cooper and anyone that's ranked highly, it's you know, it's a I just want to double down on the reminder that if you are that number one top guy or girl, I mean, literally there's no one ahead of you. Everyone else is coming for that spot. Right. So yes, exactly. It's an affirmation, but it's a reminder that everybody is coming to get where you are right now. So, 100%. All right. So enough about rankings. I think another topic I want to transition to that it's going to be great for the audience to hear for all the aspiring collegiate athletes is your kind of college experience, right? So maybe the recruiting process, what that was like, who you had around you during that process, and when you went on these visits, because, you know, for you were choosing, I believe, between Virginia, UConn, it was Kansas, like some of the top schools. Like, what went into your decision that was important to you specifically, and then maybe what are some things that, you know, any athlete going through that process right now should be aware of that maybe you weren't at the time?
Yeah. It's an interesting one. I reflect on it quite a bit, you know, as I have tried to be, you know, somebody who players that are young and going through the process can draw experience from. And, you know, I had the process happen really quick. It went from 0 to 100. Like, I was not really recruited, completely off the radar as a sophomore, went to Vegas big time. And within a few months was being recruited by every top 25 school. You know, you named kind of some of the finalists. It was like, you know, UConn, Kansas, Maryland were kind of the last three. I also was really interested in Missouri and Quinn Snyder. And I think that's kind of what my major takeaway, you know, for young players is to try to strip down all of the, you know, name of the school, success of the program, and really strip it down to the people, because at the end of the day, the people that you're going to be working with, living with, you know, succeeding or failing with are going to be the people that are, you know, behind, you know, behind the scenes in the locker room with the coaches, the assistant coaches, who's at the university, you know, talking to players who have been there before. It's very easy to get caught up in the name of the school. And I want to go to this school because it's, you know, this is going to provide me the opportunity because it's North Carolina, because it's Duke, because it's Maryland. And I really believe now more than ever, similar to if you're getting recruited, but in college, if you can really play, you're going to get exposure. So I would definitely, my biggest takeaway is to really focus on the people that are recruiting you and really focus on how they feel about your game and, you know, really try to figure out how well they actually know your game. Because it's really easy to just get caught up in the, you know, the visit or get caught up in all the, you know, glamour, glitz, whatever, however you want to say it. And forget about the fact that at the end of the day, it's who you're playing for and who you're playing with that matters the most.
Yeah. That's actually a great one there. Ask coaches, like, figure out how well they know your game, because I feel like it's so easy now for, especially with all the rankings and with all the, you know, the offer matchings, it's like, okay, well, this kid got an offer from that school. Well, we need to go offer this kid now. Right. So, you know, if you're on that visit, really identify the people that you're going to be with day in and day out, but how well the coaches know your game and how they're going to use you, because they might not have a good answer for that, or they might have an amazing answer for that, which should affect your decision relative to your other offers. So no, that's great advice.
I mean, I think and the last thing I would say on that is, if you would be surprised how many coaches, head coaches, are deep into the recruiting process with guys and really don't know anything about their game. I mean, like, you'll come to, you know, Midnight Madness in your first practice, and this in some cases is like the second or third time that the coach has ever really seen you play, you know, because at these big universities, they're worried about their former team, what they have going on. There's always recruits. There's a class with three or four guys. They might've seen you play a little bit. The head coaches that are really hungry and are really passionate about it, they should know your game as well as anybody. And if you see any hesitation or any doubt or any fumble of that articulation of your game, it's a major red flag.
Great advice. So for you, after you chose Maryland, obviously, you know, for those reasons we just discussed and more, what did you study? What was your off the court experience like? Like, did you go into it thinking, hey, you know, like when you were a freshman, were you saying, I want to be a pro? Or were you saying, hey, I'm going to go take this thing as long as I can, but I really want to study something specifically? What was your mindset like going into college?
Yeah, I went into college with a mindset, you know, once I was able to, you know, get to the recruitment process and my senior year, I started to really come into my own as a player and build confidence. You know, I really made that commitment, you know, I want to be a pro. Specifically, I want to play in the NBA. And that was sort of a focus that I had that was like, you know, an all-in type of commitment. You know, from a school side of things, for whatever reason, I had sort of a kind of a self-awareness. My parents are in education. My mom's a high school guidance counselor. My dad's a college professor, an economics professor. You know, so I understood the value of education, but at the same time, I understood my goals, as you know, and that was to be a professional basketball player. So I felt like in school, I was doing what I needed to do to, you know, have the best opportunity to be a professional basketball player. I was going to class. I chose a major that I felt like would be interesting and that would keep my attention. But at no point in college was I looking at my education as a potential vehicle to, you know, lean into at any point, other than just, you know, I want to make sure that I'm doing what I need to do to pursue my goal of being a professional basketball player, which was go to class, complete my work, you know, and get back to what it is that I really love. And I think that, you know, my mom and I talk about this all the time, and she gives people advice of where to go to college. It's very, very hard as an 18-year-old to know what you want to do with the rest of your life. Yet as an 18-year-old, you have to make some pretty big decisions in college of what you want to major in. And, you know, I think it's interesting, and that's a whole nother rabbit hole of education and college and majors and, you know, all these different things, you know, in, as far as preparing people for life after college. But for me, it was really all about basketball and do whatever I can to prepare myself to be a pro.
And so on the basketball side, speaking of having your goals, actually, first, I want to mention what I just wrote down and highlighted. When you said that your goal was to be a pro, but then you doubled down, you said specifically to go to the NBA. I think that's super important because a lot of people say they want to be a pro, but the more specific that you make your goals, easier it is to achieve them, or at least outline the steps that you can take to get there. So I thought that was worth doubling down on. But so speaking of that goal to get to the NBA, were you told by certain people that, whether it was your coaching staff or your crew around you or some agents recruiting you at the time, were you told like what you need to do or milestones you need to hit or points you needed to score in order to get there?
Yeah. I was under the impression at a young age that how I played individually was very important. And that was youth. That was an experience. I was much more concerned about my stats and how I played individually than I was about our overall success as a team. And I think that that's a major mistake that a lot of young players make is you hear how important winning is, and you hear how, you know, scouts are going to really look for winners, and they're going to look at winning over, you know, you hear all the time, it doesn't matter if you average 8 points a game, if you win and you play the right way, it's going to pay off. It's very, very hard to buy into that when you're 18, 19 years old. And when you're not putting up those numbers, you don't see that attention. And you see the people that are putting up the numbers, getting all the news stories and getting all the attention and on all the mock drafts. So you're literally like, it sounds good, but when I have a good game and when I score 20 against Duke, Andy Katz is calling and I see my name on the draft boards, and we didn't even win that game. So it's very easy to get lost in the sauce and get infatuated with individual success when you're 18, 19 years old. And so I say that because my ability to get drafted was 100% hurt by the lack of success of my team. You know, like we won the ACC championship, and if I would have done it all over again, I would have left. Because part of the other thing you learn is you can get analysis to paralysis. These scouts will find problems with you if you stay too long. I stayed for 4 years, so they knew me like the back of their hand. They knew every good thing, every bad thing. Gave me time to make mistakes on and off the court. And it gave me time to have my team go from winning an ACC championship to going to the NIT. And so I was able to learn a lot from that. And it helped me as a pro. Unfortunately, it was a headwind to get me drafted. And then, you know, when I wasn't drafted, your margin for error is very small. And when I was signed by Detroit, I had a foot fracture in summer league, which had me out for a year. And then my career went overseas. So it was a combination of the team not having enough success and an inopportune injury. But I was 100% focused on the NBA, and everything that I did was focused on the NBA to a fault. I think I was a little bit too selfish at a young age. And I think that's a common mistake for young players to make.
That's some great insight. I mean, I definitely agree with you on most of it, and I'll kind of play devil's advocate. I mean, first of all, from a scout's point of view, you're right. I mean, so for those that are listening, you know, the unknown skill set that you have could be potential, right? It's almost like innocent until proven guilty, right? Like if they haven't seen you, you know, dribble off the ball screen and go dunk the ball, then maybe he could do it. But if they've seen you dribble off the ball screen and then, you know, can't get to the rim, then they know you cannot. So, but that's tough because it's kind of a conflict of interest between helping the team and wanting the team to win, but being able to prove that you can do things, but then you got to play that middle ground. So, you know, I'll definitely just add in that it's just, it's a combination of both. So of course, I think you need to win, you need to be a team player. But, you know, if you focus all your time on being a hard worker and winning and you average 2 points a game, that's not going to help you either. Right. So exactly. it's this science, right? It's, you know, it's partial science and partial art. It's like, you know, the combination between and playing that middle ground. So, but just 100%. Some great insight that I don't think people talk about enough.
Yeah. I mean, I think you articulated it perfectly, and it is the stars aligning and timing. And, you know, I think that if you lead with winning, the rest follows. There are some things out of your control with winning, and then you also have to handle your business and play well and stand out. You can't get past that fact. So it is a middle ground. But if you lean too heavily into either one, you're not giving yourself the best chance. If you're all in as an individual, you're going to create issues for yourself. If you're all in on do whatever it takes to win to a fault, to the point where I will sacrifice my own individual success, that can also hurt you. You have to find that middle ground. And as an 18-year-old, 19-year-old, to be able to do that with all the noise around you and all the people that are trying to tell you that you're doing the right thing for their own personal gain, and all the agents and all the, you know, the runners and everything like that, to be able to navigate that stuff, you know, a lot of it's just in the stars. I mean, a lot of it's just what's meant to be will be, because there's a ton of it that's out of your control, which is the reality.
It's super difficult. You're right. And kind of speaking of all the noise and maybe transitioning a little bit into your pro career here. Can you talk a little bit about that transition? Like, I guess starting with maybe the agent selection, I think that would be a great educational topic for current college players to hear. Now, obviously, there has to be a disclaimer of every person is different, right? Like you at that point were on the radar, right? You were on the radar. The way I usually say it is, are people on the radar on draft boards or at least on that radar? And if you're not, then you're kind of in almost a different category, right? So for somebody listening that might be averaging 2 points a game and you're at a D3, this, you know, exactly what Nick's about to say might not apply directly to you, but talk about like your experience of being at that level, hearing from agents, you know, trying to figure out what was best for your, you know, to put on your team to help you get to that next level.
Yeah. I mean, there's a ton of layers to that. You know, I would say part of the pros and the cons of being from where I was from, being from Maine, I was enamored by the big names. I was enamored by the biggest name school. I was enamored by the biggest name agent because I was where I was from. I felt like I needed it. You know, I felt like I needed that credibility because I was from Maine and because I felt like I always had to prove myself. I felt like I needed to attach myself to the additional credibility. So when I had the agents coming, I was easily wrapped up in the, like, well, I had this lottery pick and this lottery pick, and I got this guy and I got this guy and I got these guys. And I ended up going with, what's the name of the guy from, West Coast agency. I can't even remember now, but I started out with Bill Duffy, right?
Yep.
And before the draft even happened, I switched to Priority Sports. So I signed Bill Duffy and I'm going through the pre-draft process, and he's got so many guys that all these other guys are getting workouts. And I'm just like, why is David Noel getting workouts? Why are these guys getting work? And, you know, a little ignorance, like these, I played 4 years. These teams knew me, like they didn't need that one more time. That's at least what they were telling me. But then literally like a month before the draft, I switched my agents. Now that probably didn't play to my benefit. I mean, it doesn't really, now that I look back and I know what I know now, it doesn't look that good if a player is firing his agent a month before the draft. You know what I mean? Like, it definitely didn't, it definitely didn't help my case as a guy who's just going to be the quiet, like, guy who's not going to cause any commotion and just know his role and stay in his lane. So I think in retrospect, that was probably, you know, when they're trying to decide between picks 40 and 60, you know, it's very small margin of, well, I'm going to go with this guy instead of this guy. And I think probably changing my agent was a factor. But, you know, again, I would say the exact same thing about your college choice is people. It's so easy to get caught up in who's giving you the most gear, who's giving you the most money, who's got the most lottery picks in the last X amount of years. But at the end of the day, it's 2020, about to be 2024. If you can play, teams are going to want you. And what you need on your side is the highest character person who knows your game better than anybody and who is going to go to bat for you and is going to treat you with the same sense of urgency as they treat their son. That's the ideal situation. And it's no matter what players want to tell themselves, unless you are, and here's the interesting thing about it. If you're like, all you got to do is show up and you're a lottery pick guy, then what do you need that agent for? It's all the more reason you don't need that agent. But if you're not that guy, then you probably don't need that agent either. So it's really strange. I mean, like, I get the top 10 agent guy is going to know how to market you, has the most connections with marketing and stuff like that. But again, you know, I would argue that you really just need somebody who is going to represent, you know, has experience, but it's going to represent you and your game with a lot of time. And that's why I switched. Bill's a great guy. I just switched because I felt like I wasn't a priority. Hence, I went to priority sports. But at that point, it was just, I mean, and Mark Bartelstein told me, like, dude, I can't give you any guarantees. Like, I'm, you know, you're switching the engine of the plane while it's in the air. Like, I will definitely put you in the best position, which he did. I was undrafted, but Detroit was 100% looking at me and gave me the same contract as they would a guy who was picked 40th. So that world to me is one that it's just very, very challenging to be a kid that age with all the, I mean, these agencies, their job is to, you know, make themselves look great. That's what they do great. And so it's really challenging to comb through the noise to like the real things that matter.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, you hit multiple variables there, and we can have its own series on agent selection and maybe we'll get into that a little bit more later, but I want to stay on track with the pro career. So, all right, you talked a little bit about being with Detroit and then a little bit about your injury. So, when you finally land in Germany, right, that was your first stop. Talk about your mindset going into rookie year. And this is going to be great for, I don't care what level you are, all rookies or all first time pro players that go abroad. Like, had you been abroad before? Were you nervous? What was, you know, had you prepped on the different culture, the different, let alone the playing style, right? Like the playing rules, like what was your mindset there?
Yeah. So I broke my foot the second game of summer league. Had navicular joint fracture surgery, which is a 8-month recovery time. It's a very fragile injury. So I missed basically a majority of my first professional season. So I went to Detroit's doctor in August, found out it was like 6 to 8 months. And I was back in Maryland rehabbing pretty much my whole first year. So that was a challenge in and of itself, a major motivator because I had no money. And I was, you know, I'd just gone from being all ACC and, you know, wanting to be drafted and to all of a sudden, you know, being a free agent with a broken foot and no guarantees, like really starting over to a certain extent. And so time went on and then it was kind of like, you just got to find a job to show you're healthy. And so come March-ish of my first year out, this team in Artland, Germany, you know, was kind of fighting to maybe make the playoffs. And it was, you know, I don't even remember how much money it was. It was maybe like $6,000-$7,000 a month, which at the time seemed like a ton of money to me. And so I went there and my mentality was just like, my career's on the line. it wasn't necessarily your typical leave, go to college. I mean, leave college, go to, you know, summer league, go to training camp in August, first year. It was like very traumatic, like no money, whole year. My mom got me a credit card, like maxed it out, need money, need a place to play, like completely humbled me. And so I went to Artland with, you know, kind of mid season and, you know, let alone as a rookie in any of these professional teams to get minutes is tough, let alone you come in mid season, never played professional basketball, never played in Europe. So I didn't know what to expect. I was not all that thrilled to be there. I felt like I was, you know, I was going to go there just to use it to get in shape for summer league. And I was going to go back to summer league and I was going to prove that, you know, I was in fact an NBA player. And so that was the focus. I went there and we ended up having an unbelievable run. We upset Alba Berlin in the first round. We ended up going to the finals, almost won a championship, and it ended up being an incredible experience. You know, they gave us the key to the city and like, it was just a really cool experience, which kind of opened my eyes to like, oh wow, this, you know, this can be really cool. And I was in like a, you know, 2,000 person town. So that was kind of my first year. And then I went back to summer league.
Got it. Yeah. And again, everyone's first year, I think is very different in terms of the situation. But the underlying theme that I encourage everyone to take is kill or go home, because at the end of the day, it is your job. It is literally your job that you're getting paid to do. So, you know, there are many cases that players don't have as high of a resume as yours. And so their leash might not be as long. So you have one bad game and you might get cut. So you have to kill or you will go home. Right. So I think that mentality was obviously the right play at the right time. But you know, I think one thing that I want to have you stress on too, and this could be maybe touching on some other stops along your career, but it's not, you know, obviously basketball is basketball and the round ball goes in the basket. Right. But there are rule differences, whether it's, you know, playing the ball off the rim or the 3 seconds in the States and the non-3 second calls in, you know, abroad, or even the 3-point line differences. You know, you go from college playing two halves to NBA and FIBA playing 4 quarters. And, you know, there's a lot of stuff that, you know, you need to be prepared for. So did you struggle adapting to that? Or is there any, you know, kind of recommendations you can make for whoever's listening to make sure that, you know, players do prepare themselves properly?
Yeah, I would say the first thing that I love about the minute you play in international basketball is, you know, you may get a little bit of a head start because of where you went to school, but the minute you check into a game, like wherever you go, whether it's Germany, Spain, Poland, once you play 1 second, you could be from William & Mary or you could be from Maryland. Everybody is immediately on the same playing field, which I think is really should be a motivator to players that maybe aren't at Maryland, should be a reality check for players that are, and everybody in between, it's the same. It's like when you get to wherever you go, you have to really respect the opportunity. A lot of players go and think like, I'm better than these players. I think that has probably been like different than now. Like 20 years ago when I came, or whenever it was, 18 years ago, like American players had this kind of like, we're better. Like, you know, I'm going to go over there and I'm going to dominate. And I would guess that players that come out of college know what it is now. Like, it is not a game over there. If I don't come over there ready to go, I will be out of there quick. But for those that don't, just know that when you get over there, you know, you are on the even playing field. You actually have to prove that you're not, you know, an ignorant American who thinks that he's the man. And you have to be humble enough and you have to put your ego in check enough to do the little things. You've got to look at it like you're the 11th man on the bench for the Los Angeles Lakers and appreciate the opportunity the exact same way. And if you do all those little things and you approach it the same way that you'd approach playing for the Lakers, you give yourself a chance. Because if you don't, then, you know, you're really creating your own headwind, because there are rule changes and there's all nuances to the game that are different, and those things will come with experience. But the very first thing you have to do is mentally go in with a completely checked ego and a completely humbled approach that you need to prove yourself, and that the bar is, you know, I can be a multimillionaire or I can be one of the best players in the world. And you have to be able to get over the fact that you're not in the NBA and really commit yourself to that process, because there are incredible things you can accomplish, but you can be out of there real quick.
Yeah. I mean, obviously I second all that. I think it's, you know, just phenomenal to hear from different people and different positions and roles in the industry, whether it's coming from a coach, a friend, a mentor, an agent, or obviously in this case, a player who went through it. I think that's definitely important. So what about, and I know it's tough to distinguish style of play, because honestly, sure, you can generalize USA versus everywhere else. But you know, Japan style of play is very different than Spain style of play. So if you had to maybe, I don't know, give an example of a specific, you know, country, maybe let's take Spain, for example. What are the main differences? You know, like if you're a college player and you're playing, you know, a lot of, individual basketball and your coach is taking the basket every time versus you get to Spain, like what's going to be different? What should players be ready for?
Yeah, I mean, I would say the two things that stand out to me the most are there's less space. Obviously, the college game, it's similar, but, you know, if you compare it at least to the pro game, there's a lot less space. You know, there's a lot less room for one-on-one. And there's a premium on being able to shoot the ball. So ISO guys who can't shoot have a harder time in Europe, because there's a lot less patience for holding the ball and dribbling the air out of the ball. You have to get off the ball quick. You have to make decisions A to B quick, get it go or get it, move it. There's no ISO hang dribble pull-ups. Those type of island ISO plays aren't there. So you really have to, you really have to work for everything, and moving without the ball, cutting, offensive rebounding, controlling, those type of things to me are a huge benefit and ways to stand out. You know, for me, I realized very quickly that in Europe, if you want to live and die by how many points you score, you better be an assassin. Because if you think you're going to be able to go to a team and average 16, 18 points a game, and that's going to be your meal ticket, it's tough. Because if you're going to be that guy, you're probably on a bad team. And if you're on a bad team, the value of those points is watered down significantly. If you're on a good team, you're going to have to shoot, you know, 50, 40, 80 to be able to average 16, 18 points on a really good team. So for me, it was, I realized early you got to control the things you can control. You know, like a good stat to be selfish about is rebounding or steals, or I committed myself to leading the league in rebounding my second year in Spain. And that was kind of my early meal ticket. To my mentality was, if I'm a top five rebounder in the best league in Europe, I'm definitely going to make more money next year than I am today. So it was like, how can I just, if I'm making $100,000, what do I need to do to make $120,000 next year? You know, and for me, it was, you have to control what you can control. And a lot of times it's effort stuff like rebounding or steals or block shots. Because if you rely on other things, that's what drives you crazy. I mean, I'm sure you see it, like players like, oh, I only got 4 shots. Well, welcome to Europe. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I went 0-for-4 and now I'm not playing. Well, it's very hard to be efficient with 4 shots. So what I would say there is, well, then you, what's going to, you know, butter your bread is probably not going to be going 3-for-4. You know what I mean? So it's tough, man. It's very, very, very challenging. You have to be very, very patient, and you have to be unbelievably consistent, and you have to be unbelievably willing to be consistent and patient. You know, it's tough.
I mean, yeah, so many gems in there that if you're listening and you're a current pro or aspiring pro, go back, rewind, and listen to again. But you know, I do tell a lot of my guys, it's like, look, you there's not one formula of how you can get to the next level. There's so many variables like winning and being a good person off the court. But yeah, I mean, you know, I had a case, for example, my guy Jamin Henson. I'll give him a nice shout here because it worked out perfectly where he had a great season in Georgia, right? It was very good. His first year there, and it was good. Like he shot, you know, around 40% from three. He averaged like, I forget, maybe 14, 13 points a game, like three or four rebounds, a couple assists. It was good, but he didn't get to where he wanted to be that next season. And I said, look, there's a couple ways you can go about this. You can either, you know, kind of cry about it, which he would never do because he has a great mindset. But I said, or you can go back and you could be literally the best scorer. Like, go win a championship, go be the MVP, and go be the best scorer. And there's no questions, right? And he literally did all three things. And now he took that step up, and now he's in Finland. And it's like, as a player, that number two scorer, he's probably somewhere decent. I can go back and check. But if you want to be the best, literally go be the best, go win everything, and go be number one. Otherwise, it's just a toss-up, right? And you know, a couple other points you said. It's like, just it's strange that there's still such a disconnect between, let's say, youth AAU here in the States, where a lot of it is dribbling the air out of the ball and one-on-one, which has its pros in certain situations because you can create with the ball. But overseas, anywhere outside the States, and sometimes in college, but anywhere outside the States is like, it's team ball. You better make that extra pass. You come down on a fast break and you dribble, 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 and shoot a pull-up three. It's like, it's not a great shot, right? You know, like you need to pass the ball, you need to distribute it. So I thought you made some great points there. And so for all those aspiring and current pros, I encourage you to go back and listen again. So another thing that just briefly I want to touch on, because you talked about just winning and how difficult it is. Do you want to enlighten the audience on how many years it took you to win a championship as a pro overseas?
I mean, it was the very last year. You know, I mean, it was my 15th
Incredible.
year, and you know, it's to me, you know, there's a lot of lessons in that, and I've taken them with me, you know, beyond hoops. But you know, one, for young players, when you do have the opportunity to win, you know, understanding how special it is and how rare it is, no matter what level you're at, to win a championship, you know, you can't take it for granted. And then also, you know, as you get older in your career, you know, just being consistent and understanding and really buying into the fact that if you're consistent, if you do the right things, you know, it may not happen when you expect it to happen. It may not happen exactly when you want it to happen. But eventually you'll get there, you know, with that follow through. I mean, it's a lot of these principles that I learned as a player, seeing through like a 16-year career, that have been so valuable to me in other parts of life, because I've been fortunate to see through the ups and the downs, the doubt, you know, continuing to work, continuing to be successful, everything that you just talked about that really unbelievable thing about sports is that accountability. Like, there is no denying if the shot went in or not. In a lot of other lanes that I've found outside of sport, there's all these ways that you can articulate and manipulate what it is, and you can push off blame and it wasn't me, it was this guy. But there's this accountability and there's this look in the mirror thing that comes with being an athlete, where you either did or you didn't. And at the end of the day, if you didn't, the only person you can look in the mirror and hold accountable is yourself. You know what I mean? If you don't want to put in the work and you don't eat right, you're probably going to get hurt. And when you get hurt, you can't blame somebody else. You blame yourself. If you don't make the sacrifices, you're going to be at home not having a job and you're going to wonder why, you know. And so there's these accountability things that you can take from it that I think are massive at the end of the day. You know, and you know, for my career and the whole trajectory of it, you know, waiting 16 years to win a championship, it just kind of made the lesson fully rounded out for me. You know, I would have it no other way at this point, because it really was the icing on the cake in my conviction of the process, the routine, the follow through, the accountability, And then just learning, like, these things do produce winning, but this type of winning, then there's a championship, and what type of sacrifices and the things you need to do with your teammates, the things you have to do off the court, the effort and time you have to put into the relationships, you know, the tough conversations that you have to have, you know, the, and how beneficial those are, you know, and albeit they're very uncomfortable, many times throughout my career in situations that didn't end in a championship, I shied away from the uncomfortable conversations, you know. But then when you get, when you're at the end, it's like, well, shit, this is it for me. You know what I mean? It was almost like I was forced by the inevitability of the end to give myself the ability to say, well, you know what? I'm going to say this to the coach. I'm going to say this to, and I don't recommend young players saying this to the coach.
Right.
But, you know, the point is having the uncomfortable conversations. And if you truly believe in something and somebody's not working, hold them accountable, challenge them. If you see people joking around and shoot around before a big game with the opponent and the guys on the other team, call them out, you know? And so like those type of things that I was uncomfortable doing are what champions do. And it took me a long time to realize that, but at least now I know the blueprint of being a champion and I can carry that with me in other things.
Man, that's so good. I mean, uncomfortable conversations, you know, it's like you said, it's definitely important to highlight. It's case by case, and you have to kind of look at yourself in the mirror and realize, okay, are you a rookie? Have you really earned that, you know, that status yet? But, you know, like I'll give another one of my guys, Donovan Smith, credit too, is like, you know, he's now in his 6th year as a pro. And I said, you know, we'd have conversations about some things that maybe he didn't agree with coach or that they could change. I said, look, you've earned it. Like you're playing at a high level of basketball as you know, almost a veteran basketball player. Have that conversation. It might be awkward, but pull coach aside. Like if you pull coach aside and say, hey, here's the way that I view it. Like, can we have a conversation about it? And that coach decides to, you know, mother F you and this, and that's on him. But I don't think most coaches will, right? If you gain that respect to have those uncomfortable conversations, it's going to be better for you, better for the team, and better for coach. So that was an incredible topic to bring up. Well, look, I think we can go for a 25-part series on your pro career, but we might have to revisit some of those conversations. I want to transition a little bit as we start to wrap up here to your post-playing career. As you know, we talk about a lot. One of the topics, if not the most important topics on this podcast to me personally and to my agency, is the fact that life is bigger than the game, right? So I can't repeat it enough. If you're a player, you have to use basketball to open doors for yourself for the rest of your life when the ball stops bouncing, because it will stop bouncing at some point. For some people, it's after middle school or high school. For some people like yourself, it's after a historic and lengthy season, right? A career. But so on that topic, I want to dive into your brain here on, you know, basically the transition that you took from playing to post-playing. You know, like when you seriously started thinking about retirement, how you set yourself up for it, what thoughts you had on what, you know, what you wanted to do next. And then, you know, we'll tap into a little bit about the cool things that you have been doing. But I just think it's so important for players to hear from a guy like yourself, you know, when you started to think about that, and maybe some pointers for what they can start to think about.
Yeah. I mean, I'm very passionate about that. I mean, it's, one of the things I would say, business partners of mine, people that, you know, work for me and I work with at this point, are probably exhausted of hearing all of the analogies I make from basketball to business and relationships. Because to me, it's really interesting and motivating for an athlete to understand that, you know, the routine of being an athlete, the type of sacrifices, the disciplines, the fact that you have to make decisions with your day to prepare yourself physically and mentally for the goal, the win, you know, practice, the entirety of what encompasses being a professional athlete, that's a huge advantage in the quote real world. Because the people in my experience, the people I've talked to, have spent a lot of time studying successful people. And a lot of the things that they lean into are the things that we take for granted as athletes, that taking care of your body, making sure that you eat healthy and you prioritize healthy habits, that you have the ability to put together a routine and follow through, work with other people, collaborate with other people, problem solve. These things that are inherent in being an athlete are very prevalent and very valuable as an entrepreneur. And I say that to say, I was very committed in my middle 20s to preparing myself for life after basketball. I was very aware and conscious of as I started to make money, trying to find ways to use it productively to prepare myself. And the way that I went about it was using it as a vehicle to learn. And I don't think there's any better way to learn than the urgency connected to your own money, specifically when you're getting this money through blood, sweat, and tears. The money that you make as an athlete, you're not putting together some quarterly, PowerPoint projection and doing some research project or closing a deal in one meeting that goes well and now you have commission. This is every single day, day after day, for an entire season to see something come to fruition. And, the same way that you don't skip a workout, because if you do, you know the consequences. The same way, if you don't prepare or you don't, communicate or read the room with your teammates and your coach, how that can affect your minutes. These type of daily principles and things that are important in basketball are very, very important with, things that you do investment-wise or business-wise. And so I would say that I became really self-aware of learning very step-by-step. And I think one of the biggest challenges for athletes or anybody who doesn't have a business degree or didn't come from an MBA program or is seeing other people doing it, seeing the entrepreneur, seeing this person investment and say, oh, I can do that too. What would your reaction be as a player if somebody at the YMCA said, I can do that too, of what you're doing in Europe? We see it all the time. Guys in the Y, like, I'm trying to go overseas. Da, 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 da. Mm-hmm. It's the same in business. It's the same in investment. If you're not fully committed, if you're not up at 6 a.m., if you're not doing every little detail day in and day out, day in and day out, you're not going to be successful. And so one of the things that I would urge players to do is, yes, you want to be an entrepreneur. Yes, you want to invest, but really take the time to connect yourself and your learning experience to every step. Don't have your first investment be this huge investment. Have it be a small one so you understand every single intricate detail yourself. You're not going to sign up if, would you say, if you're a player, I'm going to go have person A play this game for me and I'm comfortable with the result. Most athletes would say, hell no, I'm not going to have this person go play. Well, then don't give your money to somebody else and expect them to do it for you and then be upset with the results. That was my thesis, is if I'm going to lose money, I'm going to look myself in the mirror and say it was my fault. The same way, if I'm going to go out, I'm going to go out and play, you're going to have to hold yourself accountable. So I would just kind of really, really try to get young players to understand that it, really take the time to learn and really take the time to understand every single thing you're doing. Even if you're investing in a stock, just because you saw 100 people invest in Amazon, if you're going to invest your hard-earned blood, sweat, and tears, know exactly why you're investing in Amazon. Know everything about Amazon before you make that investment. If you're going to get a rental property, find somebody who's lost money in a rental property so they can tell you all the things you're not looking out for. Because everything that you see is smoke and mirrors. The reality of making money in business is so much harder. It's just as hard as it is to be successful as a professional athlete. Being a successful entrepreneur, people get that mixed up and they think that it's easy. And as an athlete, it's like, how can you possibly think that's doing something at a high level? If you're an athlete, you should know better than anybody how hard it is to be successful as an athlete. So you have that advantage. Use that advantage and approach everything you do from an investment standpoint the same way you approach basketball. And if you do that, I think that for me was the foundation of my growth, was that really hands-on approach.
Man, the last 5 minutes was a masterclass. Rewind and listen again. Honestly, it's just incredible and amazing insight and knowledge from somebody who did it themselves. But you know, I'll double down on all of that. It's like, you know, I don't think a lot of athletes understand that they have the tools to be as successful in the business world as they do in the hoops world. But it doesn't happen overnight, right? Like you said, right, it's smoke and mirrors in the business world on how you make money too. The same exact way is that it is when you see a highlight of an NBA champion, or you see a highlight of winning a championship abroad, and you don't see what the work that went in. It's the same thing. Someone's, of course, they're going to show this 47 unit commercial building that they flipped and they made $1 million at. But what about, where's the sunk costs? Where's the expenses? Where's the ones that they lost? Yeah. It's the same thing. So that was a great analogy. Man, yeah, again, if you're, I mean, that's valid for anyone in life. But yeah, if you're a pro athlete thinking about transitioning and when you're going to do it, that is a 5 minutes I would take a pen and paper and go back and listen to. So just a little bit more about what you've been up to. I mean, just to double down on some of your experience, you know, obviously people know Nick Kane or Medley as the stud of a basketball player that he is, but I don't know how many people know about the stud of an entrepreneur that he is yet. So obviously you have your real estate projects, you know, you have your co-working space, you have a nonprofit. So maybe talk a little bit about whichever one you want to, or all the above, and you know, some of the passions that you have now as you're taking this next chapter of your life.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, I mean, it was a process that through the learning experiences turned and compounded into opportunities that I wasn't necessarily going into knowledge seeking with, I'm going to open a shared work co-working space. Like that wasn't my goal. My goal, I started with, I actually started acquiring trailers in Maine, very small acquisition cost. I was buying trailers for $8,000 to $12,000 through a gentleman that I knew that owned a trailer park and had an opportunity as people were defaulting or leaving the park to pick up the trailers at the low. I would then turn the trailer around and sell the trailer, and then I would owner finance to owners. So I learned the process of acquiring a piece of real estate, just every piece of it, the, you know, the acquisition, the, you know, purchase and sale, as well as then understanding the financing side of things, interest rate, you know, how that plays, the contractual, the legal side of putting together an LLC, all of those little details that are really important. And I also learned through those small projects, things that you don't need to spend money on. People always sprint to, they want to have their shirt and their hat. A lot of what people do when they go, especially as athletes, in my opinion, as entrepreneurs, is they do it as much because they want to be able to show that they're doing it than the actual nitty gritty of doing it. Wasting money on, again, you got your hats and your shirts and your website and all these auxiliary things that are, when you get experience, you realize the real key to success is the leanest P&L profit and loss as possible. And it's actually removing those expenses. So you kind of put the carriage before the horse and you're starting with all these expenses that if you just fast forward time, you know that you'd eliminate those 10 years down the road. But beyond that, it was starting with that. And then I went into a bigger acquisition. I acquired as you mentioned, I essentially, not to be too long-winded, I started a small real estate portfolio, which through that, I built a small team of construction where I was renovating my own units. Learned the cost part, how everything is more expensive than you expect. Every, you know, cap rate or, you know, here's the numbers that this building is doing is the best case scenario. You know, it's always more expensive. There's always ways to prop up numbers until you get under the hood. So I didn't get too far over my skis. I didn't invest too much until I learned some of those things. Then I took the construction knowledge into doing construction projects for other people. And for myself, that transition to the business development, I developed a business called Cloudport that I'd seen and I saw overseas, I saw in Miami, and then I figured that it would work in a smaller market in Maine. So for athletes, when you travel and you see models that are successful, mm-hmm. a lot of, in my opinion, success as business is like, you don't have to recreate the wheel, find things that have a blueprint, find things that have been successful and put it somewhere where there's demand, run it right, run it lean. You have a pretty good chance to be successful. When you try to be a disruptor or you try to be, you know, an innovator, you better have a lot of money to burn. You know what I mean? And so I learned that pretty early and I stayed in my lane with that. And then through kind of establishing those income streams, like for me, it was like, I'm going to take one thing at a time. I'm going to prove to myself that it can create an income stream. Once it has a well-managed, leaned out, profitable income stream, I'm putting that in a bucket and then I'm moving to the next thing. This was a, you know, 12-year process now where instead of trying to do too many things, do one thing, make it profitable, see it through. It sucks. It's going to take 3, 4, 5 years. The first couple of years, you're going to be like, why did I do this? This is not what I expected it to be. Well, that's what you should expect, is that it's not going to be what you expected it to be, because it's going to take time. It's going to take money to be able to learn and put it. And that's the reason you start small to learn, go to the next one. So I put that in the bucket, put Cloudport in the bucket. And then I got into the cannabis space in Maine. I built a successful medical marijuana wholesale company where I've leaned that model out and built that team. I mean, in Maine, I have, throughout my different endeavors, you know, 50 plus employees. And, you know, what I've done is built, you know, 4 or 5 different income streams. And as each one of them over, you know, each one takes 3 to 5 years, as you put each one in a bucket, you then have more bandwidth to go to the next thing. So that's where, what I've been doing. That's where I'm at. It keeps me really, really busy. You know, I'm kind of slowly expanding each individual endeavor, adding to each bucket, and then just sort of doing it like that, looking for opportunities through the experience that I have to find, you know, the opportunities to continue to grow. And so that's kind of where, you know, I'm at in regards to like off the court endeavors.
That's fantastic. And, you know, one of the best parts about doing the podcast is, you know, I know I have a lot of listeners, whether you're a pro athlete or not. But you know, if you are a pro athlete listening and you're going through this and you have an interest in any of the things that he said, reach out, you know, reach out to him, because that's one way you're going to learn. And obviously, you know, it definitely has a ton of experience from real estate to, you know, the cannabis industry to, you know, co-working space and everything in between. And, you know, of course, from his experience has learned a tremendous amount that, you know, that might take you, you know, decades to learn. So definitely reach out if you have any interest. I'm sure he'd be happy to, you know, Absolutely. Teach you, or maybe he has an opportunity for you. Absolutely. So look, man, we've covered so many different topics. And like I said, I think we might have to schedule a second round for so many more.
Yeah, I'd love to.
But as we wrap up here, I have to, the last thing I have for you is a sports business lightning round, which I didn't prep you for, but I'm going to ask you some questions. I'm going to fire them at you and you got to hit me with the first thing that comes to your mind.
Love it.
All right, here we go. What's your favorite color?
Red.
Do you prefer coffee or tea?
Coffee.
Pizza or pasta?
Pizza.
Would you rather be able to speak with all animals or speak 4 languages fluently?
4 languages fluently.
What's your favorite country outside of the one you're from?
Spain.
What's one of your biggest strengths?
Communication.
Who was one of the first people to really believe in you?
My dad.
What is one of your biggest fears?
Failing in general, losing all my money.
if you could have dinner and drinks with anyone in the world, dead or alive, who's one of the first people that pops into your mind?
Warren Buffett.
That's a good one. I don't think we've had that one on the podcast yet. And if you could turn back time and talk to 18-year-old Nick, last one here, what would you tell him?
Just focus on winning. Winning takes care of everything.
Love that. Winning does take care of everything. Well, this was a freaking winning podcast episode, I'll tell you that much. So I appreciate you coming on, man. So many great insights and gems for any type of listener here. So appreciate you coming on, and I'm excited to have you on again, and hopefully we'll be chatting more here and giving some more insights to the audience soon.
Yeah, thanks. It was a blast. I really appreciate it. Anytime. And as you'd mentioned, you know, feel free to reach out to me, you know, at any time, email, Facebook. I don't have anything other than Facebook, but I'm genuinely happy to, you know, field any engagement. So don't hesitate to reach out.
Good stuff. I'll put all the links and all the contact info in once I launch the episode. All right, man. We'll see you soon.
Awesome. Thanks.
Thanks again for listening, my friends. If you enjoyed the episode or if it brought you any value at all, it would mean the world to me if you could give it a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts. If you share it on social media, make sure you tag me at Kevin Tarka. If there are any topics that you want me to dive into or any guests you'd love for me to have on the show, just shoot me a message and I will do my best to make it happen. Have an amazing day and hope to see you back here soon.